Welcome to VOA's International Edition for Friday, June 26, 2015. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, Islamic State fighters make a major counterattack against Kurdish forces in Syria.
They're not trying to retake the city. What they seem to be doing is to try to distract from an attack on their capital, so-called capital of the Caliphate, Raqqa.
Also, the U.S. Supreme Court hands President Obama a major victory on his health insurance law.
So today is a victory for hardworking Americans all across this country whose lives will continue to become more secure in a changing economy because of this law.
That's all coming up on VOA's International Edition. Islamic State fighters launched two major attacks in northern Syria Thursday, a fresh offensive, that is, on the Kurdish-held border city of Kobani, and a push into government-held areas in the mostly Kurdish town of Hasakha. Susan Yaki spoke with correspondent Jamie Detmer about the attacks, which left dozens dead and come after Islamic State suffered a series of setbacks in northern Syria against Kurdish forces in recent weeks.
Today there was a surprise attack upon Kobani. It looks like IS managed to infiltrate parts of Kobani, which had been free, obviously, of Islamic extremists since the siege they had on the town was lifted about January. It seems that they entered both from the west and the east. They're not trying to retake the city. What they seem to be doing is to try to distract from an attack on their capital, so-called capital of the Caliphate, Raqqa. They were dressed, many of them, in YPG uniforms and the uniforms of the Kurdish fighters. They seemed to come from both sides, as I said, from west and the east, and they did a typical tactic of starting their attack with car bombs. One car bomb, in fact, and one motorbike bomb, which blew up in the early hours of the morning. We know that there are dozens of dead. We know at least 40 wounded have been transferred into hospitals in Turkey. Most of those are civilians and some Kurdish fighters.
What about a response?
Well, at the moment, I think the Kurds are really shocked that they managed to infiltrate the town. They seem to have cleared them now. The last report I heard was that some Islamic extremists were still holed up in one building in a house. As I said, this doesn't seem to be a full-scale offensive again on Kobani. What most Kurdish fighters and rebel commanders, Syrian rebel commanders, believe is that this is an attempt to divert attention away from Raqqa. As you know, earlier this month, about June the 15th, at a very important border town that the Islamic State controlled, Tal Abyad, fell mainly to Kurdish fighters. They have pushed down further south, and are now only about 31 miles, 50 kilometers or so, from Raqqa. We also know that there have been major reinforcements of Raqqa by Islamic extremists. People have been told who live in the town to stockpile food and fuel. So we think that this is more of a distractive move than anything else.
What is the feeling there along the border?
Nervous and very confusing for people. What we're seeing in the last few months is all sides, whether it's the Syrian government forces or whether it's the Kurds or whether it's the Syrian rebels or whether it's the Islamic State, having difficulty in maintaining control of their own territories and particularly of territory they've just captured. I think this is partly because all are suffering certain manpower shortages. They don't have enough troops to always retain the territory they've captured. So we get this seesawing that's going on in terms of the conflict, who's up and who's down. Only a couple of months ago, the Syrian rebels thought that they were on a good line after they managed to capture the city of Idlib and were talking about driving down towards Homs and then upon Damascus. But they got diverted by Islamic State extremists who were very, very mobile in terms of their forces, who started to attack them further northeast towards areas that they control near the border, which completely diverted the attention, if you want, of these Syrian rebels around Idlib who had to go back northeast again. So we're seeing a very, very confused picture.
That's correspondent Jamie Detmer speaking with Susan Yaki. For reaction to this story, we turn now to Michael Lippin. Michael, how has this story been playing on worldwide social media?
Hi, David. Well, let me tell you, Kurdish Twitter users have reacted pretty angrily to today's Islamic State assault on Kobani. Many of those Kurdish activists accused Turkey of complicity in the violence, saying Turkish authorities allowed the IS fighters to infiltrate Kobani from the Turkish side of the border. In fact, those Twitter users even accused Turkey of acting like a terrorist, going so far as to use the hashtag #TerroristTurkey, making it one of the top 10 trending items on Twitter earlier today. Now, as you can imagine, Turkey rejects that label and that accusation. Its Deputy Prime Minister, Numan Kurtulmus, fired off a number of tweets today trying to set the record straight. Kurtulmus said, "The claim that Daesh, another name for the IS group, passed through the Turkish border is entirely a lie and part of a black propaganda." The Turkish official also said, "The perpetrators of today's attacks passed through the Syrian town of Jarabulus to get to Kobani." And he said that the Turkish government is on full alert to help the wounded and those in need of humanitarian aid. The Turkish deputy PM is actually a popular guy on Twitter. His handle is @NumanKurtulmus, and he's got more than 1 million followers, but he tweets mostly in Turkish. So if you want to see statements from him and other Turkish officials in English, you can check out the Turkey PM Press and Info account, which uses the handle @BYEGMENG or @BYGMENG. I'd also like to point out some good analysis of the situation in Syria on our website. Our reporter Cecily Hillary filed a piece a few hours ago headlined, "As IS Expands, Should the U.S. Deepen Its Military Involvement?" And that story looks at growing calls within the U.S. for an escalated American military response to the Islamic State group. David?
All right, that's VOA's Michael Lippin. We welcome your comments on this story and on our show. On Twitter, we're @VOA_IE. Our website, of course, is www.voanews.com. Coming up, the Supreme Court hands President Obama a major victory and will pay a special tribute to one of VOA's stalwarts.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm David Byrd in Washington. President Obama scored a major victory at the U.S. Supreme Court Thursday when the court voted 6-3 to uphold federal government subsidies given to consumers in states that rely on the Federal Health Insurance Exchange. I spoke with our chief political correspondent, Jim Malone, about what the 6-3 decision means. What does this ruling mean for the Affordable Care Act, what people have dubbed Obamacare?
It means that more than 6 million people around the country in various states that did not set up health care exchanges will, in fact, be able to keep the subsidies they need to go and buy health insurance. So it has real-world applications and impacts for millions of Americans who were worried that the court would take away the subsidies, making the price of health care almost prohibitable for them.
Now, Republicans on Capitol Hill have tried and failed several times to overturn this law. It was an issue in the midterm congressional elections a couple of years ago, or last year. Do you think they will try again?
You know, the House Speaker, Republican John Boehner of Ohio, says they are committed to keep working at trying to repeal Obamacare. One reason for that is that going back to the elections in 2010, the so-called Tea Party elections, much of conservative America was swept up in this anti-Obama health care law kind of crusade. And they're not going to give up on that anytime soon. The significance of the court ruling on Thursday is twofold. Legally, It removes one of the real legal challenges to the law. There are some more outstanding, but none of them would have gutted the heart of the law like this one would have with the subsidies. And then there's the political effects. This is the second major win for the president at the Supreme Court over health care. And Republicans may say they're going to want to continue the fight, but at this point, for the public, for many, it's probably going to be settled law.
Just about a year from now, the 2016 presidential race will be in full swing. It'll almost be convention time. What do you think this means for next year's elections?
Well, you know, this decision was a little bit of a surprise for Democrats. They thought maybe it might go against them. Then you would have had Hillary Clinton and Democratic candidates using the issue in the election. Well, the tables have turned. Now Republicans, and we've already seen this, right, people by Mike Huckabee, Rick Perry, Marco Rubio, are already saying that they're going to be running against the health care law as part of their 2016 candidate platform. So it will be an issue, but I do get the sense that with a second sort of a strong Supreme Court ruling, and don't forget the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts joined with the majority, and he's a conservative, I think it may tamp down it as an issue for 2016. The people who may really still care about it will be sort of the Tea Party conservatives, and they may be looking for a candidate who can vent their frustrations about the law as they look at primary challengers.
All right, that's VOA's senior political correspondent, Jim Malone. We welcome your commentary on this or anything you hear on our program. You can dial us up on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. You can also comment on Jim's story on this particular issue on our website. That's www.voanews.com. Coming up, the June 30th deadline for a deal on Iran's nuclear program is rapidly approaching. Toby Keith and Kelsey Ballerini make news in country music, and we'll pay tribute to one of our own. A senior U.S. administration official says Iran's nuclear negotiators might not make a June 30th deadline for a final agreement. Officials said negotiators are expected to be close to an agreement on the 30th if they can get there at all. Iran's spiritual leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has said Iran will not allow international inspectors access to military sites, scientists, or documents. University of San Francisco Middle East analyst Stephen Zunes told Victor Beatty that the Ayatollah is the most powerful figure in Iran whose endorsement of an agreement will be required, and his remarks are disturbing.
Even though Iran, of course, is an authoritarian system, it's not one-man rule. There are competing tendencies, both hardline and moderate. And while the Ayatollah Khamenei is the single most powerful, there are a lot of forces at work. And it appears that most Iranians, both in government and in the country as a whole, are in favor of moving the deal forward.
Stephen, on Wednesday, the Guardian Council ratified legislation that would ban access by international inspectors to military sites, scientists, and documents, making that binding law. Is that a problem?
These are only for non-nuclear sites. The rigorous inspection regime tentatively agreed to some months ago is not affected by this. At the same time, the agreement was somewhat vague in terms of exactly what ancillary sites would be included, so it is possible that this could be an obstacle, but not necessarily a fatal one.
How likely is a nuclear agreement on or about June 30th?
There are still a number of important outstanding issues to be resolved, the sequencing of sanctions relief with steps taken by the Iranians to cut their nuclear program, the extent of the inspections regime. But at the same time, the fact that Secretary of State Kerry is making the trip is indicative that there is some confidence in the White House as well as in European capitals that an agreement is in reach. There is the possibility, of course, of extending the deadline, but it's pretty clear that there will be a good faith effort to try to reach some kind of agreement by June 30th.
The Associated Press, quoting a confidential document, says Western powers, as part of this agreement, are offering Tehran high-tech nuclear reactors and fuel. How concerning is that?
Well, if you're an environmentalist, obviously any expansion of nuclear power anywhere, especially in a country prone to earthquakes would be a matter of concern. But light nuclear reactors do not produce the kind of fuel that is capable of creating a nuclear weapon very easily. And if providing this kind of nuclear technology in exchange for halting construction on the heavy water reactor, which could potentially have military application, one could see this as an acceptable trade-off.
That's VOA's Victor Beatty talking with Middle East analyst Stephen Zunes. His first big radio hit was I Should Have Been a Cowboy, but now Toby Keith is a member of the Hall of Fame for songwriters. He went in there recently with some pretty big names, including Cyndi Lauper and Bobby Braddock. Here to talk about that and all things country music is VOA's Nikki Strong. Nikki, Toby Keith, he has been on the country music charts for almost 20 years now.
Yes, he's major. He's major. I think he has over 17 albums. He's quite prolific singer-songwriter. And he considers getting into the Songwriters Hall of Fame the pinnacle of his career.
Rather than performing in front of thousands of people in
yes,
stadiums.
Exactly.
This is more important.
This was very important to him, to be acknowledged as a songwriter. He does say that. And he dedicates the honor to his grandmother, who gave him his first guitar.
Oh,
yeah,
well, isn't that
sweet.
Nice? Now, he also, I understand he was introduced by Stephen Colbert or something?
Yes, Stephen Colbert introduced him, and Stephen Colbert sang. And people were like, you know, he was like, okay. He knew Colbert was going to introduce him, but he didn't know Colbert was going to sing.
Right.
And Colbert did a decent job.
Yeah.
A decent job.
A decent job.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, now, also, I mentioned Bobby Braddock, and he is the songwriter who wrote one of Toby's hits. You said that he sang Toby's song, I Want to Talk About Me.
See, this is hilarious. Bobby Braddock, of course, another prolific songwriter who's written for tons of people, he performed at the ceremony, and he sang I Want to Talk About Me. Now, this was a song that he originally wrote for Blake Shelton.
Mm.
But Toby Keith wound up recording it and sending it to the top of the Billboard charts in 2001.
Now, speaking of songwriters and country music, Kelsey Ballerini is a young lady who is lighting up the country music chart with her new song, and it's Love Me Like You Mean It.
Yes, I love the song. When I first started doing country hits, that was the song that stuck with me.
Really?
Yep, it was 16, I think, on the charts at that time.
But it's number one on the airplay chart now.
Yes, the country airplay. I'm like, go Kelsey. And she's an underdog, which is what makes it great. She's not on a big-time label. She's on an independent label. So
right.
This is quite an accomplishment.
And it's a very, very catchy. It comes out at a time of summer here in the
yes.
Northern Hemisphere.
Yes.
I can just picture, you know, kind of driving down the road with the windows open.
Yes.
Got this thing going. And it's, you know, it's also significant in that it is the first country single, I understand. First time an artist has had her debut single land at number one since Carrie Underwood did
yes,
it.
Yes, first female.
Wow.
Yes. So this is perfect timing in light of the backlash, you know, when you had the major radio consultant that was saying women are tomatoes, they're garnishes, they're not the meat. And here comes Kelsey Ballerini, you know, topping the country airplay chart.
Which means more disc jockeys are playing this
exactly.
song.
Exactly. It means that people are liking the song as well, that people are listening and it's testing well.
All right. Well, if you have any questions or comments about either of these stories or anything you hear, you can hit Nikki up on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Also, you can listen to this segment again at VOA underscore IE for International Edition. You can check out Nikki's show, Country Hits USA, by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. Click on the Programs tab. You'll find it there. Nikki, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David.
We want to take a moment to recognize one of our soon-to-be former colleagues who is leaving VOA this week. Andre Dineshnera started with us in 1980. He's worked as a correspondent in Geneva, in Moscow, and in London. Pete Heinlein sat down with Andre to talk about his career.
Andre, when did you start at VOA?
Started in 1980. December 1980, so it'll be 34 and a half years.
And what were you doing in 1980?
1980, I was hired by VOA as a writer, and was on the various regional desks, and then became a correspondent and was sent to Geneva in 1984 to open the Geneva Bureau.
It was Cold War era, and Geneva was sort of a midpoint between East and West, where a lot of the action was taking place. What did you see in Geneva?
Everything over there. I mean, at that time, yeah, like I said, OPEC was in full gear. The arms control negotiations between the United States and the Soviet Union, the Iran-Iraq talks. It was a bureau that was full of news.
Well, you were the first VOA correspondent in the Soviet Union.
That's correct.
Actually, you may have been the only one.
That's right, because after that, during the Gorbachev era, everything came to an end.
This was a momentous occasion in history, and you were there. How did you cover it? How did you see it?
We would need 150 correspondents to cover what was happening in the Soviet Union at that time. The whole system was disintegrating. Every day was just full of surprises. I told the kids that they were witnessing history that will be written in history books. And so it was an unbelievable time because you never stopped.
Could you talk about the geopolitical significance of that moment?
I never thought I'd see the end of the Soviet Union in my lifetime.
That's VOA's senior international correspondent, Andrei Dineshnara. We thank him for his service. I had the privilege of sitting next to Andrei for the past 10 years. He was one of the people in the building, from the director's office down to the interns, who would be sought out for his counsel and advice. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. We welcome your comments on our program. You can find us on Twitter at VOAIE. Our website is voanews.com. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/Voice of America. Tracy Carter directed our program. David Magnus was our engineer.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a panel on the sidelines of the 29th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues, Sarah Sewell, called on members of the council to join the United States in encouraging the Chinese government to live up to its international obligations to respect Tibetans' distinct culture, identity, and fundamental human rights. Special Coordinator Sewell spoke of the barriers and challenges facing the Tibetan people. Citing the State Department's Human Rights Report on Tibet, she noted that the Chinese government engaged in the severe repression of Tibet's religious, cultural, and linguistic heritage by, among other means, strictly curtailing the civil rights of China's ethnic Tibetan population, including the freedoms of speech, religion, association, assembly, and movement. In response to the international community's concern over the Chinese government's actions in Tibet, China has responded with additional tightening of its already strict controls on Tibetans' fundamental freedoms. Chinese authorities have also taken actions to denigrate the Dalai Lama, whose views, said Dr. Sewell, are widely reflected within Tibetan society, and who the U.S. believes can be a constructive partner for China in addressing continuing tensions in Tibetan areas. The United States has consistently urged the Chinese government to uphold its international commitments to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms, specifically by ending the harassment, detention, and other mistreatment of individuals who seek to peacefully practice their religion, express their views, or seek legal redress. The United States, Dr. Sewell said, calls on Chinese authorities to release Tibetan Buddhist teacher Tenzin Delek Rinpoche and other prisoners of conscience, and to allow Tibetan filmmaker Dundup Buangchen to be reunited with his family. Like any people, said U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues Sewell, Tibetans have an inalienable right to be stewards of their unique cultural, religious, and linguistic heritage. They have a right to do so without interference, in peace, and with dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.